Well, I could say that I'm at Tom's Diner doing this, but that would be a lie. Because I'm in my own dining room recording an interview with author C.L. Fornari, and not just author, but garden expert. She also has her own show. We'll find out about that in just a second. Let me welcome in the author of Coffee for Roses and 70 Other Misleading Myths About Backyard Gardening. C.L., it's good to talk to you.
Oh, it's so good to be with you.
And the first question I have to ask is one that I'm sure a number of people want to know the answer to, which is, why CL? In a very friendly way, when you and I were first communicating, I kind of dropped a line in the in one of my messages that said, hey, what does CL stand for? What do your friends call you? And you conveniently ignored it. So,
well, my usual response to what does CL stand for is a name I no longer use. But I tell you, I have my radio audience convinced that CL stands for compost lover. So we'll just leave it at that.
And that's fine with me. You stick to your guns. I'm happy with that. I do not have a problem. I just want to say, let me just say, I love your book.
Thank you.
And one of the reasons I love it is here you are, and as I mentioned in our communications leading up to this, I love busting myths about gardening. But it also scares me when people get a little too, what would be the word, preachy about it?
That would be the word.
Yeah, and you don't do that because, for instance, you talk about one of the myths about marigolds in the garden, in the vegetable garden, and how they are supposed to keep bugs at bay or pathogens or whatever, and you debunk that, and then you say, yeah, but we put our marigolds in the garden every year anyway, because it's now tradition.
That's right. That's what my husband says. At this point, it's traditional.
Why not? And there's really nothing wrong with that. You can do that, and certainly marigolds perk up a garden. They make it look great, but it is important for folks to know that if you're doing it as a remedy, it's not necessarily going to work.
That's right. Well, I tell you, Mike, one of the things that I wanted to do in this book was to make the debunking of the myths as much fun as some of the myths are. And it was funny because I had originally spoken with the publisher of the book, St. Lin's Press, about doing another book. And when we were on the phone intending to hammer out a contract for this other book about annuals, the publisher said to me, well, I see on your website that you have this talk called Myths, Lies, and All the Latest Dirt. He says, I think I might want to do a book about that instead. And my response to him was, well, I'd be happy to do a book about that, but only if I can make it as much fun as the talk. Because I feel like, first of all, that's one reason the myths are sticky. That's why people remember them, is because, some of them are quirky and kind of fun. And so I wanted the book to be that way. But also, I feel like gardening should be fun. There are enough things about it that are frustrating and serious that we should try and make it as enjoyable as possible and have as many laughs as we can.
Yeah, but you know what? Even that is controversial at the moment, the idea that gardening is fun. I read something recently, I think on Garden Rant, where there's a back and forth about maybe we're better off telling people that it's hard work because it really is. I mean, how do we balance that? the idea that it's fun and that it's hard work. Because if you want it to look good, you're going to have to do, you're going to have to put some work into it. One of the great things you point out in your book, at one point you say, weed for 10 minutes for crying out loud. Don't kill yourself. And,
right.
And I find that works for me because in my backyard, let's say I'm walking out to the garage, I might stop for 5 or 10 minutes and do some weeding. And then you've gotten a start on it and it doesn't seem so overwhelming. But I think the point is well taken that And I keep telling people this in my own talks, there's no such thing as a maintenance-free garden. There's not
absolutely
even...
Absolutely not.
Yeah.
But you know what, Mike? There's no such thing as a maintenance-free life, right?
Right.
Everything in life worth having takes effort. But it can also be a lot of fun. And the garden is no different. We have to embrace the whole of it. The fact that it's work... The fact that it's intellectually stimulating, the fact that sometimes we tear our hair out, the fact that it's so darn gorgeous, and the fact that it's fun.
Well, maybe yours are so darn gorgeous.
Oh, come on.
I've seen...
Focus on one flower. It may not be the whole is, you know, gorgeous.
It's true.
But, you know, one, sometimes, you know, if we just sort of open our eyes, we can focus in on this little detail in the garden, you know, the way the sun shines through one leaf or one particular flower that is at that moment breathtakingly perfect. You know, we have those moments all the time as long as we stop to experience them.
You'll have to excuse me a moment. I'm tearing up here.
All right. What can we badmouth to counteract that?
Well, you know, let's talk a little bit about some of the myths you have in here. And one of the things, there's an underlying theme with a lot of them. And one of the themes that you come to over and over again is the idea, do it the way nature does it. And it usually has to do with soil amendments and digging and the whole idea of that double digging. I love the way you put that to rest. And when I started gardening, you could read about this, and I'm sure you still can. People saying, "Oh yes, you must double dig your garden." And when you think about it, and after a while, you begin to realize how absurd that whole thing is, because nature certainly doesn't double dig. And the other thing you realize is that most of the nutrients that the plants use are in the upper 6 inches of the soil, or even the first couple of inches of the soil. So
That's right. Why
are you messing with that?
You know, I think in thinking about double digging, I think it's like hazing rituals for a fraternity. That people who have gone through it, they believe that other people should have to go through it too because they went through it, and so why should anybody else get off scot-free, right?
Yeah.
And I think people who have double dug, they're the ones that are keeping it alive. Because, you know, they broke their back, and so why should the rest of us get away without it?
I've just decided there's a phrase to be used there. I double dig dare you.
There you go.
and you can use it without paying me any fee. Go right ahead. But again, that whole double digging thing, and then you talk about it in terms of rototilling, in terms of do you bury your amendments in the soil? Do you bury your fertilizer in the soil? And the same thing keeps coming up over and over. And I would say 10 or 11 of your myth bustings there, that was said rather ineloquently. But the point you keep making, and I hope it gets home to folks, is... It's often the easiest way can sometimes be the best way, which is use compost, because compost is great. And often all you have to do is lay it on the surface of your garden and you're done.
Right, right. Well, you know, Mike, I think that some of these myths, they come from a sweet part of ourselves in that we humans want to help, right? And we want to help our gardens, and we want to do it right, and we want to do it better. And that's a very sweet thing. So I think that some of those things about double digging or you know, scratching in fertilizer or whatever, it comes from that part of us that wants to help. The best way sometimes, however, to help in when it comes to nature is to stand back and see how Mother Nature does it, you know.
Absolutely. And I'm happy to say that it made me feel good because I've been doing these interviews for 17 years now. And I've always considered myself, because I don't have a horticultural background. People say, what's your background in horticulture? And I say, showbiz, which is true. Because I started out as an actor. But after 17 years, you learn things even by mistake, by accident. And I think the people I've had on my shows must be pretty smart because they have taught me, you know, I figured about 90% of what you had in the book, I knew. I already knew that stuff.
Good.
And there were a few that I had never heard of.
You know, the giving peppers the hot foot,
yes!
by planting them with matches. Yeah, that was a new one to me, too.
Explain that one, because it's so bizarre.
It is bizarre. Well, the myth is that in order to have good peppers, you plant them with matches in the soil.
Meaning matches that you strike to light a fire.
That's right. That's right.
And you just put, and the matches before you strike them, you put them in the soil.
That's right. When you plant the peppers. Now, I don't know where giving the peppers a hot foot came from. And when I looked into this, there are people seriously debating why this might work. You know, they're coming up with theories about sulfur in the tips of the matches, and by the way, sulfur matches no longer have sulfur in them, so even that doesn't make any sense.
Right, as you point out, it's phosphorus.
Yeah, exactly. But the amount of anything that the tip of a match could possibly have on it is so minute that this is one of those things that I'm sure it got started because somebody had an idea and did it, and then their peppers that particular year did well, and from this they started talking about how I did this and I saw that, and that alone, you know, is a myth. I did A and then
right.
and saw B, and therefore A causes B. We know that that's crazy. And yet that's how some of these things get started.
Well, that you actually put that in there as bonus myth number 71. I tried it and it worked, so it must be true.
That's right.
And a lot of that is just coincidence, as you point out. Sometimes
sure.
these goofy things, but sometimes
sure.
the
we all as gardeners have seen that. First of all, sometimes plants thrive against all odds. You know, somebody could do everything wrong and that plant would live, right? Oh, we see that. We also see that the weather and you know, growing conditions in any particular year have a huge effect on what does well and what doesn't do well. And sometimes plants don't do well, and despite all of our thinking and trying to figure out why they haven't done that well that particular year, we never really come to, you know, resolution about it. And that's how it often is in the garden. So why we persist on saying I did this and saw that and so this caused that, it doesn't make any sense.
Among the ones I had not heard was you can't plant pumpkins in the garden with squash because they'll cross-pollinate and you'll get squumpkins.
Yes.
It's funny.
I have actually had people call my radio show and said, I grew squumpkins. My squash must have crossed with my pumpkins. And maybe the squash did cross with the pumpkins, but it did it the previous year and then seeded, you know, or the seed might have been bad. But that rarely happens. When you're buying seed from seed companies, it rarely happens that you get accidental crosses.
Another one I had not heard of, let me find this here. It is, the hydrangea, putting nails in the, rusty nails make hydrangeas turn blue.
Mm.
I had never heard that.
Well, you know, if you ever come to Cape Cod, sometimes the hydrangea is our signature flower out here, and there are people who are determined that rusty nails turn hydrangeas blue, to the effect that I had one man once keep calling me back to argue with me about it because he was so determined that it was true. And it's a funny thing, and I think maybe a confusion over the fact that a metal, aluminum, is actually responsible for hydrangeas turning blue, and it's whether the soil is acidic that allows the plant to take that aluminum up that drives the whole thing.
Which of these, now, I mean, how long has the book been out right now?
The book came out last year at the beginning of June,
okay.
So not quite a year.
All right. I imagine, I mean, you got a radio show and you hobnob with your fellow garden writers. Which of these have given, for which of these have you had the most blowback?
Let's see, blowback in terms of...
People look at it and say, no, you're not right about that. I will take issue with that.
I think probably it would be the one of oak leaves and pine needles making soil acidic.
Well, people, as you mentioned...
Hard one to counteract because that's one that people are really convinced is true.
Okay, here's the deal with the pH of your soil. It can be changed in a limited way for a short time, but ultimately, unless you keep that up all the time, it's going to revert.
That's true.
And as you point out so accurately in that particular chapter, if your soil is already acidic, it's going to be acidic. If it's already alkaline, it's going to be alkaline, and it's really not going to change much because of oak leaves or needles. You're absolutely right about that. But as you say, people have this idea. No. That's really why it works. the heck with the science.
And you continue to read recommendations that, well, if you want to grow acid loving rhododendrons, mulch with coffee grounds. And, as if the coffee grounds would change the pH of soil, where the reality is, first of all, most of the acid in coffee has come out into your coffee cup when you've brewed the coffee. So, and number two, any organic matter, oak leaves, pine needles, coffee grounds, as it decomposes, pH comes to neutral. It's, you can make your compost pile out of pure coffee grounds from Starbucks, and once that has broken down and is finished compost, it'll test around 6.5. That's just how the chemical process works.
Yeah. So while we're on the coffee grounds thing, let's go into the name of the book, Coffee for Roses. That's just one of the myths you have in there about putting coffee grounds around your roses, and in this case, it's not so much to change the pH of the soil, but it's about nutrients for the soil, because you mentioned that a lot of people put coffee grounds and also banana peels and eggshells, and they put them around the base of their roses assume that this is doing a good thing for the plants. Explain that.
Well, it's not that it isn't doing a good thing for the plant. Coffee grounds, eggshells, banana peels, all organic matter. What do roses love? A lot of organic matter. So certainly all of those three things are fine for roses, but they have no magic rose woo-woo. And that's what people think that they do. The myth is that coffee grounds in some way have this some special property for roses. But basically, roses want that organic matter. It doesn't matter if you use your finished compost, composted cow manure, composted horse manure, composted, banana peels or tea bags. They respond to the organic matter, and that's what it's all about for roses.
Uh-huh. And you're probably better off going with the composted stuff that's been composted already, rather than having it compost at the base of the plant, because if you don't want it to be unsightly, now you got to be digging in there, and
right.
it doesn't seem to make sense.
Yeah, unless maybe if you had a layer of mulch that you tossed your coffee grounds underneath, but I don't know about you. I don't want to see banana peels and eggshells laying around under my rose bushes.
No.
I'd like the roses to be the star of the show, so I would prefer to compost first.
No, but if you have a red rose and you have that yellow of the banana peel and you get that, you get a color scheme. You got a color scheme going.
Well, I want to tell you a little story about the title of the book, Mike, because this book was originally going to be called Garden Myths, because the publisher felt like Garden Myths, it told people immediately what it was, and people could remember it, and that's what it should be called. And so it had a whole different cover, and the title Garden Myths up there, he then took that cover and the title to his sales force, and the sales force said, well, we like the idea of the book, but the title and the cover are boring. And so he came back to me and he said, the sales force says it's boring. What else can we call it? And so I came back to him with, I think, three titles that came from myths in the book. And one of them was Coffee for Roses.
Ah.
And that's what we ended up calling it.
I'm with you there. I mean, I think anything that debunks myths is interesting.
Mm-hmm.
But if you just call it debunking myths or myths in the garden, it doesn't have that zing. You really have to, it's hard finding the perfect title. It really is.
Sure.
And I think you got a good one here.
Well, thank you.
It's easy to remember. And then you've got the subtitle. So, and that's where the information always is located, in the subtitle.
Absolutely.
So you've got coffee.
And then, you know, having the title Coffee for Roses, it allowed me to take a picture of my, you know, old vintage coffee tin, and we used that on the cover. So perfect.
I'm being too lax here. I should remind folks that we're talking to C.L. Fornari, who is the author of Coffee for Roses and 70 Other Misleading Myths About Backyard Gardening. It's published by St. Lin's Press. It just came out last year. So I assume it's selling well.
It has been selling well. It's gone into the second printing
there
as
you
of
go.
January. So that's a good thing.
That is
a
good thing.
And it's been a fun book to talk about, as well as it was a fun book to do. So,
well, I could look at any one of these subjects, and we could do a half an hour on each subject probably. But there are a couple that I want to get to before we finish. One of them is one that I have felt for a long, long time was a problem, and that is household cleaners make good garden remedies.
Mm.
And it's interesting because when I was, I did take Master Gardener courses here in Illinois. I am a Master Gardener. And back in the 90s when I was taking the courses, the teachers in those courses, every time somebody would mention the name Jerry Baker, they would just roll their eyes. And you knew a speech was coming or something about it. And a lot of people can remember Jerry Baker. I don't know if he's still on PBS.
I don't think so, but I could be wrong about that.
But this is the guy that was called America's Master Gardener. And he would do these programs, and he would always have these home remedies that you could use in your garden. And it always featured Dawn soap and Old Milwaukee beer. And it was always Old Milwaukee. You know, I don't know why Old Milwaukee beer was the beer of choice. and something else and something else. And I would sit at home watching that, and all I could think is, wow, that sounds like a lot of hard work. That sounds like a lot of work to put it. And then he would say things like, oh, yeah, and just add a little tobacco to this, and I didn't know it at the time, but now I look back and go, yeesh, what are you doing, pal? Do you know how poisonous tobacco is?
Especially, That's right.
Especially
and he posed it as if it was making everything easier, but then to come up with these home remedies, you had to buy things that, you know, normally you wouldn't have around, and, you know, not to mention waste perfectly good beer. It really was actually a shame, because what he encouraged people to do was to grab things, whether it was out of their kitchen cupboard, refrigerator, medicine cabinet, that have no business being out in the garden, you know.
Like ammonia.
Yeah.
You know.
So that was a shame, because it was a needless sort of throwing of different elements outside, and completely ignores what, you know, so many of us continue to stress to gardeners today, which is everything is connected to everything else.
Yeah.
And whatever we're putting out into the landscape, it has an effect somewhere. It has to go somewhere. And so, you know, we need to really be much more thoughtful about what's being applied, not only because it may or may not work, but because it does end up in somebody else's water table.
Well, you know, in the recycling world, I've been involved in recycling in Chicago for about 10 years, and if you know anything about Chicago, you know Chicago can't recycle. And one of the things I've learned, not just over the course of those 10 years, but in the course of all the years that I've done my radio show, is that there's no such thing as away anymore, as in throwing away.
That's right.
There's no such thing as away. It goes someplace. And you were mentioning a quote by Barry Commoner, which you have in your book, and you write, in The Closing Circle, published in 1971, Barry Commoner wrote, "These four laws of ecology that are worth remembering today, in and out of the garden, these are wise words." And they go like this: everything is connected to everything else. Everything must go somewhere. Nature knows best. There is no such thing as a free lunch. Which is probably my favorite, because you're right. You know, and the idea that you could take this stuff out of your cabinet in the house and throw it on your lawn or in your garden, and as my instructors back in my master gardener education days always said, look, you can go to a garden store and the products will have the quantities on the bottle, on the package, so you know exactly what you're using. Why would you mess with formulas and come up with a product that you can't replicate?
That's right. And you know, why think that taking something out of, you know, the Epsom salts out of the underneath the kitchen sink or the bathroom sink, why think that that's a good idea if you don't know if your soil needs magnesium? You know, just something as simple as that. It's continues to be problematic there. And this is sort of over the garden fence information that continues to get passed on in Facebook groups and you know, online forums, where people are, you know, continuing to kind of run amok with the under-the-sink remedies.
Yeah, recently I saw one, and when they make the rounds everywhere, and in a Facebook world, suddenly you see them everywhere, because I have a lot of gardening friends on Facebook, and so one of these remedies will pop up, and then suddenly it's everywhere. One came up recently, I want to say about a year ago, and it was, I don't know if it was for insects or for diseases or what, but somebody had posted it, and it contained Epsom salts, and they spelled it Epson, and all you wanted to, you looked at that and you went, no, they manufacture printers and things like that.
But wouldn't they be happy if somebody started a rumor that if you throw their products in the garden, your plants will grow better?
Maybe that might work. I hadn't thought about that. So there we were I was looking at that and I started researching it, and as you point out in this book, because you have a chapter on Epsom with an M at the
Right.
salts at the end, unless you have a magnesium deficiency, you have no reason to use Epsom salts. Who's the one, the woman with the garden professors? I've had her on my program.
Linda
Linda
Chalker
Chalker
Scott?
Scott, yes,
Yes.
who I love, but I have to admit, she scares me a little bit, okay? Because she's so ferocious about the science, you know?
Science.
And if you go to their website, see, in your book, CL, I was not intimidated. I looked at these and I went,
Good.
oh, this is good advice, great, and it's very friendly. When you go to her site, I get scared sometimes. I think I'm never going to comment there because I'm just going to get smacked down.
Well, it's funny because one person who reviewed my book on Amazon, she was disappointed that I didn't include more of the science, right? And my feeling was Linda Chalker Scott does that very well and has done that in several of her books that are fine books. Why would I need to replicate what she has done? I don't. And I want people to find the debunking and the information, which does have scientific basis to it. I want them to find it enjoyable. I want them to find it accessible. You know, I think that, in a way, serves me and my style of teaching a lot better. So that's the direction that I took it.
And I was conscious of that as I was reading your book. I looked at it and went, okay, I get it. This is meant to be user friendly, and especially friendly to somebody who might not realize that a lot of these things are myths. Somebody new to gardening. In fact, it occurred to me that it would be a very strange thing if a gardener's first book were this one. Can you imagine what they would walk? Because you know, and I both know, and I've seen this on radio. You tell somebody something, and then they write back to you, and they say, "Well, you said on the air that," and then you realize it's been completely misunderstood or twisted or so
Sure.
forth. So imagine somebody who doesn't know a lot about gardening picking up a book on gardening myths. How many of those myths do you think are going to get burned in their brains, and they're going to misinterpret and twist it and say, "No, she said this works."
Well, it could happen. It could happen. You know, we humans are a quirky lot, so.
We really are. And by the way, getting back to Linda Chalker Scott, if anybody's interested in following that up, you go on Facebook to The Garden Professors. They also have a blog.
Yes.
Jeff Gillum is one of those people. There's four of them who are the core of the group, and they're very science based, and they want their conversations to be science based. And for me, it's a little bit intimidating because I'm a radio guy. What do I know? But they have great information. It's just wonderful information, and you can spend hours going down that rabbit hole or the rabbit hole of any given topic,
Sure.
once they start putting links and so forth and you follow that up.
Sure.
The other thing I want to bring up is this. Well, first of all, again, something that appears over and over again in your book is that if you really want to know about your soil, get yourself a soil test.
Sure. It doesn't cost that much these days, and more information than you'll ever have use for, you will find from a complete soil test. So.
So that being said, you're number 10 here in the book. Give annuals a fertilizer with a really high middle number to encourage more flowers, and add superphosphate to the soil when planting perennials.
This was something I learned when I became a master gardener 20 years ago. That's what we were taught. And we were taught it because at that time, the sort of accepted wisdom was that phosphorus encouraged flowering. And so adding phosphorus to the soil was desirable if you wanted, your annuals and your perennials to bloom well. Now we know phosphorus is a pollutant. And many states or local areas, particularly those that have shallow water tables, are starting to regulate the amount of phosphorus that gardeners put down in the soil. So, and I was interested, actually, one of the many things I learned when working on this book was when I contacted the folks at Proven Winners and I asked them about phosphorus in the soil and phosphorus in fertilizer. And they said, well, you know, so many of our new annuals are coming from South Africa or New Zealand where there is no phosphorus in the soil. So these plants wouldn't know what to do with it if it's there in small or large quantities, right? So that was interesting to me that, you know, here these plants, the Calibrachoas and the Scovolas and all of these new annuals that have been introduced over the past 15 or 20 years, they're nitrogen hogs, and you know, they would just walk by phosphorus without even saying hello.
Well, you're right about one thing, is that for the longest time, superphosphates were all the rage. And the idea was you're supposed to, if you want to get a bloom, you're not going to get any blooms, you don't have any phosphates. And then we began to become aware of just how dangerous it was to over-apply phosphorus to our soil, because as you mentioned, it runs off, it pollutes our, I mean, look at the Great Lakes, look at Lake Erie and what happened last year. A lot of that is phosphorus. That, you know, and we thought we had solved this problem in the 60s and 70s because this was happening when we took out the phosphates out of our detergents. But now we're finding that those phosphates are going back into the lakes. And it's we were able to control it at one point because we took this one product off that was used by everybody. But now we have lots of different products that leak these things in, and we don't need to make it worse as gardeners by putting more phosphorus. And as a matter of fact, speaking of soil tests, I had a soil test done in my yard several years ago. And you'll be interested to know that my pH here in Chicago is somewhere between 7.3 and 7.8.
Wow.
Yeah.
Interesting, huh?
Very alkaline. Very alkaline.
Is that typical in the Chicago area?
Yeah, we're very alkaline here. Clay and alkaline soil is what we have here. Which is why I tell people I have a trick for growing blueberries in Illinois. Move to Michigan.
or move to Cape Cod.
Or move to Cape Cod.
Most people in my area garden in a sandbox, acidic sandbox. I have an odd mixture of sand and clay that very closely resembles cement on my property.
So. But it's acidic.
It's acidic, that's right. It's kind of a mix of everything the glacier dropped as it moved over my part of Cape Cod. And so I've got sand, I've got clay, and it's acid soil.
And getting back to the phosphorus deal, I had that soil test done, and my phosphorus was through the roof.
Interesting.
Yeah, and I do not generally use fertilizer. I'm one of those people, and I have said it in public, and I'll say it again. Fertilizing is overrated, in my opinion, for most things. And I think it's a way for companies to sell product.
Absolutely. It's the American way, Mike.
Yeah. If some is good, more is better.
Right.
That's
exactly.
The way we are.
It's why shampoo bottles say rinse and repeat.
Yep.
Nobody needs to wash their hair twice, right?
And you're actually
if they tell you to repeat, that means you use twice as much shampoo and you have to buy the product more often. And fertilizer companies have taken the same approach. Fertilize every time you water, right?
Yeah, and more we're finding out that that if you wash those oils off your body, you're not doing yourself any favors.
Right.
So, but that was the point. I mean, I don't even add fertilizers to my yard, and the phosphorus was very, very high.
Right.
And again, so that points out the need for people to do a soil test. If you're really not sure, check it out. But I'm almost going to guarantee that your phosphorus level is going to be adequate, if not too much.
Right.
Well, there's so much in here that we could talk about. You talk about trees. I have lots to say about trees, the thing that I agree with, and again, it's how we've changed things over the years, planting a tree, there's no need to bring in all that amended soil. Just, you know, you break up the soil, that is already there to give the roots a chance and remove the burlap. And the other thing to keep in mind, as you point out in the book, is plant it at grade, meaning you got a flare on the tree, a root flare that should flare right out to the ground level. And what I discovered the hard way was that some bald and burlap trees bury the root flare.
In the process they get buried. That's right.
Yeah. And so if you get a
it's deceiving for the homeowner. You know, you can understand. You know, a homeowner tries to plant the tree in the correct way, but it's deceiving because you can't really tell where the proper soil level is.
Right, and you have to sometimes dig the root ball. You know, if you think the top of the root ball is grade and that's where the root flare is, think again. Mm-hmm. You really got to pull that soil away and make sure that the tree is at grade, because if you bury it too deep, you're done. You can bury it too high and get away with it, but if you bury it too deep, you're never going to be able to recover that tree.
Right, right.
So anyway, folks want to find out more about Coffee for Roses and 70 other misleading myths about backyard gardening, they can go to the website, which is coffeeforroses.com.
That's my blog. That's right.
And you also have gardenlady.com.
Gardenlady.com is kind of my main website. And there's some gardening articles there as well. And Coffee for Roses is my blog where I express my garden geekiness and my love of cooking. So,
Any other sites that the folks should know about?
No, I think that's it. And, you know, they can always check out the book online or go to their local bookstore, even better, and support their local bookshop.
Well, it's a lovely book, and you have lots of wisdom packed into it. And really, it's not a difficult read. And, you know, like 135 pages, you got a lot in there.
Good.
71.
Good.
And it's great stuff. And it's been a pleasure talking to you, CL, and I hope we do it again soon.
I look forward to it, Mike. And you have a wonderful rest of the winter and an early spring.
No guarantees here. But before I let you go, I got to ask you, how many inches of snow have you had out that way?
Oh, we got in the first blizzard, we got over 2 feet here where I am on the Cape, and then, you know, several drifts. Then we got a combination of snow and ice, and so right now my driveway is an Olympic caliber luge run.
Wow.
And we're expected another 6-8 inches tomorrow.
Oh, my goodness. Oh, my goodness. Yeah, and we got 19 here in Chicago a couple of weeks ago, and everybody's whining, and it's, you know, you think it's the end of the world, but I just keep thinking of what's happening on the East Coast.
That's right. Well, at least, you know, my hydrangeas are well mulched by the snow, so that's a good thing. And, you know, my idea of winter interest, you hear people talk about winter interest in the garden. My idea of winter interest is a good book and a cup of tea. So I have time to indulge myself in that direction.
Well, I think you should do that today.
Excellent.
All right. We'll talk soon.
All right. Take care.
Bye-bye.